Welcome to Unyielded, thriving no matter what. In a world of constant change and challenges, it can seem hard to keep up, no matter how hard we run. Yet we all know those people who seem to handle everything with grace and grit. Seemingly, nothing throws them off their game. They are engaged in what matters most to them, they are achieving the success they desire. In other words, they are creating the life they love to live, no matter what challenges and surprises show up. We call them Unyielded. My name is Bobby Kaler, and I'm your host, and I'm so excited to be on this journey with you. I mentioned that it's a journey, and you might find yourself anywhere along that path. You may be starting out, you may be mid-career, or considering your next career. You could be an entrepreneur, a salesperson, or you may be that person who just feels like something else is calling to you, and it's time for a change. My mission is to provide stories that inspire us, so that when a surprise shows up and threatens to derail us, we will choose to persist. I will also provide practical skills, perspectives, and ideas that will help us create the habits of thriving and flourishing. Because at the end of the day, it is all about providing hope, knowledge, and assurance that we can all be more fulfilled and successful if we choose. Let's get right to today's episode. Welcome back to part two of my interview with Andy Williams, whose superpower is definitely being intentional. Let's pick the conversation back up. When we spoke before, you had talked about that whole thing around embracing uncertainty.
Yeah. And it, you know, for me, it started with trying to be in control of everything and having to understand that things out of my control were having such significant impact on my life. You know, I came out of undergraduate school, got my first job, went into consulting, had, I think there were 15 of us probably that started basically on the same day. And 1 year later, 13 of the 15 were promoted. And I was one of the two that didn't.
Oh boy.
And it had nothing to do with job performance. I had changed managers four times. People just kept leaving the company. And I kept getting bounced around. I didn't understand networking and building advocates and all this. I'm 23 years old. I'm just trying to do good work, right?
That's right.
But I beat myself up for that. Like, what am I doing wrong? And, you know, what do I need to do differently? And I literally like went into my current manager and he was like, oh, nobody put your name on the list. I was like, what? And then I was mad for no apparent reason, because that I just fell through the cracks. And I think that was one of those moments where you're just sort of like, huh, yeah, there's not this big fatalistic, you have to be careful. Like, you can end up with a fatalistic view. There's fatalistic on the one end, and then there's sort of deterministic, which was what's kind of described as the belief that if I push this button, that X will reliably happen. And then there's the in-between, which is life is just kind of fraught with an uncertainty. And I think to save myself the anxiety of thinking that I was always doing something wrong, I had to evolve my thinking a little bit. So that's where it came from, I guess.
Nice. No, and that makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you've got four different managers in 1 year, I mean, that's brutal.
Knowing now what I know then, you know, I would have probably done a few things differently in terms of advocating for myself and things of that nature. But I'm not proud of how I handled the situation. I was probably not the best employee. It turned into a bit of a chip on my shoulder, and well, that's something you company did to me. You kept moving me around, and again, that's the wrong way to look at it as well. So I. Certainly some maturing has happened for me between then and now, but such a predictable situation. And I'm sure someone, you know, right now is getting into that situation with job changes, and, you know, they're probably putting the weight on their own shoulders saying, well, I've got to do all these things. And, you know, they tell me that, you know, this is what it takes to get ahead. And especially in large companies, you know, this is, it's called a survivorship bias. So you look at who succeeded and you say, well, okay, well, that's what they did to succeed. And you start believing that, well, if I do those things, I will succeed. And it doesn't always, like, that's not always true, right? To say that a person got here and most of the people who got here did these things, it's not the same as saying everyone who does those things will get to that position, especially if you're talking about getting promoted in companies. It's a pyramid.
Yeah.
It just, you know, not everyone who checks all the boxes is necessarily going to make it through. And that's another one of those moments. Like, I had a moment like that and it was like, why did I get passed over? And I didn't get passed over. There wasn't a better candidate. It's not the same thing, right?
Right.
There's a limited number of spots available. I can't take it. You know, there are things that I can do to improve myself for the next time, but I can't take offense necessarily to it.
Clearly, you've had a ton of success in your career. And after the first of the year, you took a sabbatical. You clearly learned a lot because you ascended in a very large organization. So what do you think contributed to your success? And then if you'd tell us a little bit about the sabbatical at the first of the year and how that came about.
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, over the last three, I guess we'll say phases of my career, I approached things with a different mindset than I probably did in the first half of my career. So in 2008, I kicked off sort of the consulting phase of my career. And I, you know, went in with intentionality that I was going to become a leader and that I was going to be willing to flex and adapt and do whatever it took to get there, because I felt like it was important for me to get sort of that experience. I'd mostly been an individual contributor or I'd worked in sales. And I felt like, you know, it's time to move into leadership positions. And, you know, at the consulting company, 2008, 2009 was not a good time, obviously, no. in really any industry. But I, you know, you decide to adapt and do whatever it takes. I went from being known as sort of an analytical problem solver, like give him complex technology problems to solve and see what he can do. And I expanded. I expanded into sales training and I expanded into other areas that I would have thought completely anathema to who I was and what I was trying to accomplish. But every time I kept leaning in to those spaces, good things kept happening. So back to, okay, if I'd had a master plan, I would have missed all of those opportunities. So instead, I responded to what came ahead of me and I stayed focused on constantly improving myself. And you know, within the consulting, you know, organization, three promotions in 3 years, and I go from, you know, individual contributor to leading managers and salespeople. And that was super fruitful part of my career and really enjoyed the company I worked for. And then during that time period, you know, I met an amazing woman and decided that she was far more important than my consulting career, and made, you know, what some might have thought would be a difficult decision, but for me it was as easy as it could be to move out of consulting, where I was on kind of partner track in consulting, and then go take a corporate job. And the best job that I could find at the time was back as an individual contributor again. Wow. So, you know, there's some financial sacrifices that can't come with that, and a little bit of, like, you know, self-reflection, but it was just as my previous decision to take some chances and do things that were out of my comfort zone. It was rewarded many times over. So again, from individual contributor to manager, and then to a director position again within 3 years. And then that company got acquired and moved into an even broader role, leading training and sales excellence, And it, again, just responding to the situations and honoring the people around you as much as humanly possible. So when you're in supporting roles, consulting roles, enablement roles, you know, your impact is through others, right?
Mm-hmm.
So just staying in it. And, you know, for me, I'm kind of have this analyze, strategize, create process. So find someone else who's got a problem, help them analyze it, help them strategize how to get through it, and then create a path forward. Hmm. And that's true when you're coaching, and it's true when you're, you know, figuring out how to merge two 200 person sales forces. It's the same process. It's somebody else's problem, too complex for them to solve. I guess I kind of have a knack for, you know, listening to people and hearing what their concerns are, and then just getting in there and getting it done. So, you know, for me, again, that was very fruitful, getting to be a part of leading organizations and leading and building a new organization. But again, back to a decision that might be hard for other people, but super easy for me. So we have an 8-month-old son at home. And when we started the journey a year and a half ago, we made the decision, my wife and I, just, hey, we don't want to be the kind of people that look back and say, oh, I wish I would have, or, oh, I, you know, I'm going to eventually. So we've been aligned on these kind of decisions for years now. So my wife, who was in a consulting career, 10 years of consulting.
Wow.
And just basically called it quits a couple years ago, said, I need to be fully rested and get my mind straight and be coming at being a mother and a wife from a clear mind and a stable starting point. And she loved her career. And it wasn't that it was the wrong thing to do, but it was about putting the first things first. And for me, that meant the same thing this year. It was a decision we had already made a long time ago that the future us was going to know that was going to be the right decision to make and that we were going to do it. And so sure enough, COVID slowed that down by maybe 6 to 8 weeks, delayed the decision or the timing of the decision, pushed it from March, April out to June. But other than that, yeah, it was just crystal clear because we had already decided how we valued things, how we valued the time with family versus the money that could be made. And again, being blessed with being in a position to do that, obviously financially was good for us as well and important. I don't want to come in here and make it sound like, oh, here's what everybody needs to do. They should take an unpaid sabbatical and good things will just magically happen. With a lot of forethought and planning from several years back, we were able to put ourselves in a position to make these decisions now.
Yeah. Well, and you guys had some challenges with that too. You know, when you decided to start a family.
Yeah, this is, you know, as I mentioned that my wife basically stopped working her consulting career a few years ago. So what predicated this was we got pregnant pretty much as soon as we started trying the first time. So we'd been married 2 years, like, okay, it's time to start a family. Sure enough, we were blessed and we're pregnant. And unfortunately that story does not have that part of the story doesn't have the storybook ending. It was a chapter that, began with a routine checkup that didn't go well. My wife was first kept for overnight observation and then basically was not released from the hospital. So several weeks of being basically bedridden and having doctors tell her week in and week out, like, hey, we got to get to week 24. If we get to week 24, then probabilities start going way up. And I was at work. It was week 23 and six days.
Oh.
And got the phone call, obviously, that you would never want to get, a heartbreaking moment for us. And obviously very difficult, and the difficulty in a moment like that is that you understand the value of all those small investments. Back to this idea of, okay, so you put in more work into your marriage, you put in more work into, you know, building kind of your relationship and the path forward and the vision of what you want to do. And it's moments like that where you get to, in a funny way, so you reap the rewards of that, because we were able to just kind of lean into each other and feel the hurt, but there was never a moment where there was any doubt that the two of us were going to come through that strong.
Yeah.
And that was where let's stay on the path. It could have been easy to say, well, maybe Suzanne, maybe you should go back to working, you know, we'll focus in, you know, we'll go put the focus back there and then we'll see what happens. But, you know, that wasn't the cards that we were dealt, but we didn't want to, you don't want to look back and you don't want to contextualize sort of a whole new scenario just because one little thing happens. Nothing had changed about that picture, that vision that we were painting, that painting that we were putting together. Maybe the timing had changed, mm-hmm. but we were still moving toward it. So, you know, Suzanne went back to work part-time for a little while after that, but then it's like, no, we're moving forward. And yeah, happy to be back at this moment.
Yeah.
It's obviously a delightful time, and you know, all this fits into a story that we get to share with people and talk about the impact of the investments we made and in each other and the decisions we make along the way, and how, while you never know for sure, there's so much that's uncertain, that shouldn't slow you down from moving in the direction you want to move in.
Yeah. And I'm so happy for you guys now, because I can't even imagine what that was like. And then you said the investments that you make and how, you know, there's something that triggered in there, and reminded me of something from our prior conversation when you said, you know, is it a verb or is it, you know, verbs, not labels, or something like that. Can you set some light on that?
Yeah, that's definitely a credo for us. And I think we stole that from someone. I wish I could give the appropriate attribution, and maybe it's from the five love languages book or something. But we try to be super careful about putting ourselves into a position where we're describing anything about our relationship as a label, really as a noun. So, you know, that the question you should be asking yourself isn't, do I love my wife? The question is, what have I done in the last 2 weeks to be loving toward my wife? And then that requires one action on my part. It requires for me to be asking and checking in with her, because it can't just be in my own head, like, hey, yeah, I feel like I'm doing a pretty good job on this. Yeah. There's so many ways that passes through. You know, they say love, honor, and cherish. And for me, this current chapter in my life is asking myself a lot of questions about honoring and cherishing. We focus a lot on the love part. Like, okay, what can I do? What could I do differently that would be more honoring? That's probably not it feels like a very classic, or, you know, almost kind of an old school notion, but it's been a nice thought experiment for me. That's, again, starts as a thought experiment, but then it gives me action, which is, okay, well, there's some things I can do differently. Here as we move into the next 2 weeks. So that's a good one for us. And we're kind of revamping our kind of family vision and values. And that's been one of the things we've been talking about, is making sure that the words that we've got on there are verbs. Not everything translates perfectly to a verb, so there's a little extra effort.
It takes some work.
Figure out how to turn things into action words.
Yeah. And now that triggers another memory of our prior conversation when you guys were getting engaged. And I think it was Suzanne who was like, hey, we're going to be intentional about this. Like, what is this really, you know, what's this going to look like? Do I have that right?
Yeah. So, you know, there were some key conversations that we had during our dating time where she really said some things that were at the moment were at the time for me were kind of very convicting, like, oh my gosh, that's a high bar. And it was, right. You know, it was really about how to, the expectation that I would both lead and be full equal partner. And I don't think anybody had ever really defined leadership for me in a way that had those two things being compatible. Luckily, mm-hmm. There are actually a lot of good places to learn about what good leadership looks like and what the word leadership really even means. But at the time it was like, well, I don't know what that looks like. Can you give me an example? You know, and you know, I think we spoke about this before. There wasn't a template. You know, certainly,
no.
You know, my parents were not a great example of this. And you know, for Suzanne, there were some characteristics and flashes, I think she would say, in her parents' relationship. But some of that was probably developed later in life, and was kind of hard fought battles of, you know, being together and kind of learning it along the way. But you know, here Suzanne was saying, "No, we're gonna start there and stay there."
Wow.
Yeah, and it just her confidence is so compelling that when she believes things in a way that you just feel like, I mean, for me, like it just made me feel amazing because this wasn't like her saying, "Here's what I expect out of you." There's nothing about her that ever was communicating, and here I have these expectations for you. It was I see this in you.
Wow.
I know it's in you, and I know you can do it, and we're going to figure out how to do it. I just wanted to let you know that I see it in you, and that we're going to make sure that that comes out. And that's been a, wow, both a daunting moment, but also a bit of an ego boosting moment. Like, oh, wow. Like, okay.
Yeah. Now,
you believe, I believe.
Yeah. It's like in coaching when we say, you know, you hold up a mirror of what you see in the person, which is sometimes beyond what they see. You know, it's in a positive way. That would be both kind of daunting and, I don't know, scary or whatever it might be.
I can look back at it and I think very fondly, but yeah, in the moment it was like, I almost wanted to turn and run. Yeah, I think you've got the wrong guy.
Yeah. Like, so wait a minute. No, that's great though. In a minute, I want to move to, you know, what you're doing now, but I've got to ask you, when we talked before, because I'm so surprised, Andy, when you said that you're not disciplined and then you share, you know, you've been working out 5 days a week, because don't you do 50 Ks?
Well, I should be careful to say, I have run a 50K trail race.
Oh my goodness.
Finished in 7 hours, which was exactly my target, which, just to give a frame of reference, that would put me, I guess about a third of the people who are running would have already finished at that point. So that give you an idea of how fast or slow a little bit.
That's good.
Thank you. So about 6 months prior to that, I was out on a run with a friend of mine, and we weren't even talking about exercise really at this point in time. He's just the kind of guy who asks thought-provoking questions. And he said, "Well, when's the last time you failed at something?" I kind of looked at him like, why would I want to fail at something? And his point was that maybe I was playing things a little safe.
Oh.
And you know, this was kind of like late. This was in the fall, I think. So it was about the time where you start thinking about like, okay, what do you want to do different next year? And he was really encouraging me to think differently about how far out in my discomfort zone maybe I should be aiming. So that, well, let's start with some small ways to stretch myself in the discomfort zone. So I went from running, you know, 8 to 10 miles would have been a max run for me, to running a 50K. But as with anything, I didn't just go out and run one. I said, okay, well, if I'm going to do this and I'm going to do it well, like, what do I need to start doing differently? So I had to change my workout routines and to change my diet and diet for sure, which was a fun exercise because I started out by going with keto, which if you're married and you try to go with keto, you realize that, that's kind of hard to do unless your partner is all
both
in on,
gotta do
on,
it.
on keto as well. But yeah, so that was the start of trying to think differently about some of these goals. And I think how that manifests itself right now, at one point in thinking about taking a sabbatical, it was, well, I'll take a sabbatical and I'll go back to work. And as we started getting kind of later and later into the year last year, my wife and I were just like, that doesn't feel like the right thing to do anymore. Taking a sabbatical now means moving on, even if we don't know what moving on is going to look like. So I started really approaching it with that mindset. Okay, how do I prepare myself personally, my family, and then my team at work for me to just move on? And that was a scary notion. You know, you talk about, you know, having kind of trust in moving way out in your comfort zone. So that was the idea is I'm going to do this. And then there's going to be a moment where I'm going to feel probably like a failure because I'm, you know, cash flow is all moving in one direction. So what does that look like? So, so the decision had already kind of been made, like, hey, let's do this. Now it was the tough work of like, well, what's the timing going to look like and how would I really know? And I think the key thing, and I shared this when we spoke before, you know, the net of what a leader has to do is to create clarity for his people, ideally listen and show empathy and be human. And that's more of a how, but it's an important one. But it's clarity and growth. So where are we going? And then I'm going to help you as a team grow there individually toward wherever we're headed. So when the COVID crisis hit, you know, I knew I already had this plan. Okay, I need to make sure these things move quickly. So it was, you know, I stressed very much with my team right away, like clarity of where we were headed. So while organizational leadership was basically like, okay, salespeople are pulled out of the field for the next couple of weeks, you know, I led sales training and I said, let's assume it's the rest of the year.
That's right.
Because that you can move toward, even if it's wrong, that's a direction. That meant that everyone on my team knew, could start making their own decisions because they knew the filter. Do we push this out a couple weeks? No, we're planning through the end of the year. Should we just band-aid a few things in our e-learning? Like, no, this is going to be through the end of the year. Like, you've got your filter. So I worked hard to create clarity. The growth question was the tough one. And I shared this. You know, I had to go sort of person by person and go, okay, are they going to grow more without me than they are with me? And if not, how do I set them up for success so that I can walk away knowing I'm going to grow more the next year? And I feel very confident in that. My successor. So I'm happy to know that the person that I was grooming to replace me was selected to replace me. So they're clearly going to grow, obviously, in the coming year. And then the rest of the team is going to grow under her leadership because she's got new vision and new thoughts about where to go. It's not about my plan or my strategy anymore. And, you know, at that moment, it's like, why am I still here? I've done my job. I have prepared the team. I have stewarded them to this moment and someone else is going to steward them forward. And it's almost anticlimactic. Like my last meeting, it was sort of like I was already gone or something. But it's fun to know. It's like, I'm not wanted or not needed there, but that's success.
I mean, that's the ultimate success, the ultimate sign of a great leader. When you prepare the team so that they don't need you anymore.
I hope, and so I'm young enough that there will be many more chapters over the course of my career. So I hope that I can tell multiple versions of that story.
Yeah.
I'm somewhat early in my leadership process. You know, my previous company before that, you know, I was happy to be able to look back and know that two of the managers that I had groomed on my team, you know, ended up basically picking up right where I left off, and one of them ended up making partner. And, you know, so it's those kind of stories that I hope to keep collecting them over time.
Yeah. And it's a powerful, great story. I mean, it just really, it's a great testament to you and your leadership, and kind of leads us to, I know you're getting ready to embark on something new.
Yeah. So this is new territory for me. I have joined a startup. It's an odd time to be joining a startup.
Yeah.
Particularly when there's not much kind of new demand in the world for businesses. Everyone is just trying to struggle to keep their heads up. But I have joined a technology startup, working on the commercial side of the business, and really just trying to help this team figure out a path forward. They had a product that they had brought to market and had some challenges, and then the market's cold, and you know, now it's almost like going back to the beginning and sort of re-envisioning both who we're trying to be, like from a vision and strategy standpoint, and also using this as an opportunity to get kind of healthy as an organization, I guess maybe would be a key way to think about that. Like, what do we want our core operating model to be? How do we want to be different than other companies? And that's as much the experiment that I'm going through right now, which is, it's not just about launching a business and the business and strategy and those aspects that I've got tons of practice on that side of the business, but it's fun to be thinking about new operating models and trying to be more of the, I guess what we're calling it is sort of a evolutionary-based management principles. So less hierarchy, less command and control, less of the things that people tend to not like about companies.
That's right.
Quite
That's
honestly. Right. You know, be like, oh, what do you like about companies? Oh, I love hierarchy. I love rules and control, centralized yeah. authority.
Love micromanaging.
Can I have more secrecy? can I get more being treated like a box on an org chart and not a person with real talent and mastery? So that's another key piece is trying to figure out what the most honoring way to operate is. And the original founder of the company, that's a very important word to him. And when he shared that with me, I was like, oof. That really resonated, because as I mentioned, I was trying to figure out how in my personal life,
that's right,
how to bring honoring into it, turning that into a verb. So here I am looking at it from a professional standpoint. How do I be honoring to every other team member? How would I treat them differently? How would I communicate differently? How would we structure our work differently? So that's the how we're trying to do it. That's been fun. And the what that we're trying to do, I'm going to go way into sort of the sort of technology or details, but suffice to say, the short answer is we're looking to take advantage of kind of the emerging changes in the internet, and the blockchain being one of the key ones, Internet of Things being another key one, and all of these changes are going to power kind of new business models. And those new business models, one of the key things that they're going to have a challenge with is trust.
Yeah.
And a lot of businesses, you know, it's funny how some big name businesses that we think about as being super concrete actually are, if nothing else, just really just trust services. Uber is a trust service. Uber makes it so that you trust that this random person showing up in front of your house is going to get you where you want to go. I mean, Uber's not a car service. I mean, that is the benefit, the exclusive benefit that they offer. But the reason why Uber exists as a company is because you wouldn't just trust any random person to show up and take you somewhere. they do facilitate the transaction, but you don't really need Uber to facilitate the transaction. You could just use Venmo to do that.
That's right.
So Uber is an example. I mean, there's lots of examples. I mean, Airbnb is an example, like, that you trust that the place that you're going to stay is secure and in good working condition, and that you're getting value for your money. And so if we really want to unlock a lot of potential from an economic standpoint, trust challenges are going to be key. Hmm. And this really hits emerging markets the worst, you know, because, you know, how do you trust somebody across borders and nameless and faceless? And, but if we think about all the inherent sort of challenges and biases and struggles that we look at having right now, a lot of it is because we trust our kind of visual instincts, which aren't very good, honestly.
No.
So how do we build technology and processes and capabilities that help us move past that? It can really be beneficial, especially, again, in emerging markets. So that's kind of the broad sphere that we're hoping to operate in. We're trying to figure out our place in the world. We're not the only ones trying to do this, but we're trying to figure out our place in that world.
I mean, it sounds really interesting. And I have to ask you this. What made you, why was this something that you said? I mean, because you probably had tons of options. Why this?
So there's probably a couple features to it. One of them is definitely the organizational model.
Mm-hmm.
So the pitch for how we're going to operate as a company and the journey we plan to go on from an operating model was as attractive as the business problem that we're trying to solve. So that it's very exciting to me. You know, if I dug out a copy of the letter I wrote supporting my application to grad school back in 2002. And I have the word. It's like when I was trying to describe my ultimate mission, and it was making organizations more effective. So here I am at a moment in time where I have taken a sabbatical and taken a deep breath and tried to recenter myself. And here this opportunity appeared. It has been this notion that I've strayed a little bit from, but, you know, here it was. So that was definitely, you know, key piece is that operating model. There's also a bit of a burn the ships mentality. You know, I could have doing something less familiar.
Yeah.
Will force me to answer some tougher questions about myself and what I'm really interested. You know, I could go do some sales training work, or, you know, do some facilitation. I could go work in sales operations, all these things that are super familiar to me. But if I really want to move forward, if really what I care about is helping people, you know, reach their potential and helping organizations not get in the way of people reaching their, you know, organizations should be helping facilitate people reaching their fullest potential, not, you know, being places that are a drag on that. All those other things would have just been too safe.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think I needed to burn the ships a little bit, and I needed to feel a little bit more like I might fail.
Well, and that reminds me back to what that, you know, your friend said when you were out for the run, right? Which is, you know, basically making you think about how do I stretch my, I think you called it your discomfort zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This, and I stole this from somebody, I think it was Michael Hyatt podcast. I think he mentioned that there's a, and he may have taken it from someone else, that there's the comfort zone, the discomfort zone, and the delusional zone. And
I like that.
And you should be aiming in the discomfort zone. And some of us aim barely into the discomfort zone. And maybe sometimes you need to get right up to the edge of the delusional zone. And my friend was challenging me. He's like, yeah, I get it. You're aiming for the discomfort zone, but it's like right outside the, you know, the line from comfort to discomfort. How about you go to delusional and then pull back a tiny bit.
Wow. It's a good way of thinking about it, you know, and I'm also kind of, I'm chuckling because I'm thinking about sometimes I think I hit the delusional zone a few times, but you know what? You still learn and you still grow as long as it's not, you know, fatal.
A friend of mine and I tried to launch a website, would this be 2004? We had no idea what we were doing. And, you know, we outsourced the development and we managed to get some pilot customers. And we actually got like to do some small pitches for some investors with no experience, no idea what we were doing. And we had, you know, like we were delusional. Like the fact that anybody even talked to us is just a miracle of miracles. You fast forward a couple years and there are big name companies that basically ended up doing what we were trying to do a couple years mm-hmm. earlier. But we had no idea what we were getting into. And, you learn a lot from those, obviously, but your likelihood of success is so low, you kind of have to go in knowing like, okay, I'm probably going to fail, but I'm going to learn from the situation. So it's not failure. That's just growth, right?
That's right. It's not failure, you know? And I'm chuckling. In 2001, my husband and I moved across the country from Chicago. We went to Portland, Oregon. 2 weeks before September 11th happened is when we got there. And we're like, hey, we're going to start a business. We had no business starting a business. And then September 11th happened and the economy was terrible. And we're like, you know what? This might not be a raging success, but I bet you that we'll learn. And so you can't regret it.
Yeah, there's so many of the paths my kind of life journey has taken. I have a little bit of that. And I think it's fair to say that maybe a few more calculated risks would be beneficial for me.
Yeah,
because hopefully the idea is that will accelerate things. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned, okay, what direction am I headed in? How quickly am I getting there? Playing it safe won't speed things up.
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. And yet it can be so hard, you know, to let go of the certainty or the comfort zone. So, well, it sounds like,
our brains crave certainty. Even if something is non-beneficial, we will err on the side of something that feels certain.
Mm.
We play such tricks on ourselves. Like that's, you want to talk about one of my pet peeves is when people fall into something, prefer something simply because it sounds more certain. Like, but you prefer this other thing. Like that's crazy.
Yeah. Why are you choosing it? You know, I don't know if anything is certain.
Yeah, back to the embracing uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
If you can just treat everything as uncertain, it'll reduce the likelihood that you fall into one of those traps. It's like, well, there's no guarantee. And I'll even catch myself again when you live with someone for long enough and they hear you repeat the same thing often enough, they'll say it before it even comes out of your mouth. So I'm sure my wife has heard me one too many times, like, correct my own language so that I don't sound as certain as I probably sounded the first time. So I'll say something with certainty and then I'll back up and I'm like, well, it's likely that.
That's right.
Or we can expect with some certainty that blank. She's just looking at me like, all right, I get it. We can use straightforward language here.
Oh my goodness. But there's so much to it. This has been great. I really appreciate your time. Andy, if someone wants to reach out to you or learn about what you're doing, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, I would say start with LinkedIn. Fortunately, with the name Andy Williams, you can be a little harder to reach there, but it is Andy P. Williams. And if you find an Andy P. Williams in Atlanta, Georgia, you're hopefully finding the right person. Yeah, I can share for you when you post this. I'll be sure to share an email address and other contact information as well. But I'm always happy to have a dialogue or share whatever I can.
Perfect. And we'll make sure we put in the show notes too. You know, we'll give a link to your LinkedIn profile. So, this has been fabulous. Any parting words of wisdom for someone as they're, you know, trying to maybe embrace uncertainty or any of the things we've talked about?
Yeah, I think for me, I'll come back to the notion that you don't have to be this super powered, disciplined goal setter. Mm-hmm. That you can just as easily think in terms of short periods of time with high uncertainty about where you're going to end up, but just be intentional about this next period in time. And just, if you just keep staying intentional about what direction you want to move the next 2 weeks, the next 2 weeks, the next 2 weeks, and you have this broad vision of where you're going, that can be as motivating or more, in my opinion, than getting super precise about, you know, 10-year and 20-year goals. So I'll encourage people who don't feel like that part is working for them to know that there are other ways to do it.
There's definitely other ways. And sometimes like the 20-year goals, I think, my goodness, it can cause so much anxiety versus just continually keep moving in the direction you want to go.
Absolutely. You want to talk about making a difference. If we could reduce anxiety for people. Yeah. If those 20-year goals are causing anxiety, stop it. Just
right.
All that stuff where they say that you have to do that to be successful, ignore all of that junk. Because mm-hmm. the anxiety that it is causing you is going to be a bigger barrier than the non-goal setting, mm-hmm. for sure.
And it also takes you out of the moment.
Hmm. Yeah, we miss so many signals, right? There's two frameworks. I know you probably you're going to tie up on that question, but the two ways to think about what we do. You can try to plan and predict, or you can try to sense and respond.
Mm.
And back to that idea of driving the car. I mean, if you try to plan and predict and then there's an accident, what do you do, right? Mm-hmm. How about go in with the mindset of I'm going to sense and respond? You've got a destination, you've got a direction, and you've got a speed. But once that happens, now let's sense and respond instead of plan and predict.
Yeah. Man, that makes a lot of sense. And that just resonates for me, the whole sense and respond. Wow. That was good. That's a perfect way to end. So thank you so much for being here and sharing all of this. Oh my goodness, this was great. I was taking notes the whole time.
And well, thank you. And you know, for me, I love what you're trying to do here. You know, hopefully this came through in some of my answers. Like I want people to thrive in whatever way they define it and with whatever unique skills and motivations and cares, like just whatever we can do to help people be their own authentic selves and live their most fulfilled and authentic lives. Let's do what we can.
Yep. And that's it. That's a perfect way to express it. Cause that's just where my heart is, you know? So I appreciate you being here and sharing and helping other people along that path.
Hopefully this will continue to be a journey. We'll see where maybe some of your listeners, maybe I'll find ways to connect directly with them and help them.
That'd be cool. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
I have to admit this. It took me a few times of listening to this episode to harvest all of the gold in this conversation. Here are my many takeaways from part two. Number one. Sometimes a master plan can obscure better opportunities for us. Way, way back, I think it might have been 2003 or so, maybe it was even 2002, I heard Alan Weiss, who's the author of Million Dollar Consulting, speak. And he said that he was skeptical of master plans because how do we know that we've aimed high enough? And sometimes if we set a goal and we reach it, how do we know the goal shouldn't have been bigger? Number two, decisions are easier when you've identified what you value. Number three, the work that you put into the foundation with your spouse helps you when challenges and tragedy strike. Number four, He said, it is not, do I love my wife? But what have I done in the last 2 weeks to be loving towards my wife? Now, I loved that. Number five, I love the distinction that he made between I expect this from you versus here's what I see in you. The latter helps people step into their potential, and it can be very, very motivating. This triggered a memory for me from more than a few years ago. I was doing leadership retreats for high school students, and one of the staff members commented during one of my workshops that I didn't treat the students as though they were kids or like they were cats that had to be herded, but rather I treated them with the respect of, here's what I believe is true about you and where I see you. And she told me that it seemed like that created like an invitation to them for them to really step up and into their potential. Number six, ask yourself, when is the last time that I've failed at something? And that this can be a very powerful way to put ourselves into the discomfort zone. And usually when we're in the discomfort zone, that's when we learn something and when we grow. Number seven, when you are stretching yourself, there will probably be a moment where you feel like a failure. And that's okay, because it is simply part of the process. Number eight, a great leader sets up everyone around them, including themselves, to grow. Number nine, sometimes we have to burn the ships behind us in order to really grow and reach out to something new. And number 10, he talked about the comfort zone, the discomfort zone, and the delusional zone. And instead of hanging out in the comfort zone or just slightly outside of it, like we sometimes do, sometimes what we really need to do is venture to the delusional zone and then pull back just a little bit. Like he said, it might be scary, but we're probably going to learn and grow. And finally, number 11, playing it safe won't speed things up. And to add my own two cents here, we probably won't learn anything new either when we play it safe. So there you have it. I told you there were a lot of them. I mentioned at the beginning of part one that there were a ton of good things in this conversation. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did when I got to talk with Andy. And I felt like I came away with so many new epiphanies and insights that will help me in the future. Don't forget, you can check out my eclectic but essential leadership book list at unyielded.net/leadership-booklist. Again, this has been the Unyielded Podcast, where we are committed to bringing stories and guests who can help us all live more fulfilled and authentic lives. If you found it helpful, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on Apple, as it's the very best way to help us share this message. I don't know how you feel about 2020, but it seems like maybe there are a lot of people who could benefit from hearing a hopeful message, so please consider sharing. Until next time then, stay well, stay strong, and stay positive.